Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Reports today that a Jordanian extremist group is claiming responsibility for yesterday's killing of an American diplomat in Amman, Jordan. The news, if confirmed, is hardly a shock. Ever since Lawrence Foley was shot in his driveway, it's been suspected that terrorists were behind the attack. What's notable is that increasingly Americans seem to be at risk even in the Arab countries that have long been Washington's strongest allies. It is one small indication of a shift that seems linked to the White House campaign against Iraq. Connection listeners, over the next few weeks as part of a special series, we're going to look at the key countries surrounding Iraq, looking to better understand the regional dynamics, the governments, and the people. Today we focus on Jordan. In simple terms, it is the country that may have the most to lose, pinned as it is directly between Saddam Hussein's Iraq and Israel. How can we understand attitudes there in what may be the run-up to war? How much is Arab sentiment against Israel part of the picture? And what can the U.S. expect of this ally? We'd like to hear from you about the importance of looking beyond Iraq, a look ahead to what a war might mean for its neighbors as well. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me on the program today from Amman, Jordan, Rami Khoury. He is a senior regional analyst for the International Crisis Group and a syndicated political columnist. In a studio in New York City, Fuad Ajami. He's professor of Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University School for Advanced International Studies. And first we'll turn to Nicholas Pelham, who's a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, also in Amman. Nicholas, you're covering the latest details of the shooting of the American diplomat. We understand there are some reports of an arrest. What do we make of those?
Yes, it's still too early to confirm that the arrests, which did take place last night, are linked to the killing of Lawrence Foley. What we know is that there was a shootout in the city of Amman. It's a city several hundred kilometers south of the capital, and that the security forces did arrest a man who they say was an extremist. But what doesn't seem to be confirmed yet is that he is an extremist linked to the killing of Lawrence Foley.
And what about reports that this organization, which I think last year claimed to be the organization behind the killing of an Israeli businessman, they call themselves Honorables of Jordan, is also now claiming to be behind the killing of Lawrence Foley. How much do we know about that, Nicholas?
The Jordanian authorities are encouraging reporters to treat the claim with caution. The tone coming out of the American embassy in Amman is slightly different. What they're saying is that they do take them seriously. The group who are called the Honorable Men of Jordan, Sharafa al-Udan, only known in one other instance, and that is in the killing of an Israeli businessman in Amman just over a year ago. And it's a fairly significant link because it was the same group. The group chose the same newspaper to publish their claim, and the killing of that Israeli took place very, very close to where Lawrence Foley was killed yesterday.
Now, Rami Khoury, in your overnight column, you're saying whether or not that link is firmly established or not. Certainly, the death of Lawrence Foley is, at least in the eyes of people there, seen because he is a symbol of America.
Yeah, I think it's very clear that the people who carry out these kinds of acts are choosing symbols that represent to them things that bother them, whether it's American policy, Israeli policy, or sometimes they attack their own governments and regimes. So he is very much a symbol. He wasn't attacked, killed because of anything personal about him or what he did.
The odd contradiction is that if anyone at the U.S. Embassy would be seen to be responsible for the distribution of that extra money that's coming from Washington to Amman, it's Lawrence Foley in his position with USAID. Do we read too much into that, Rami?
Yes, I think you do. I mean, it's exactly the opposite. People are attacking Americans because or this American was attacked, because there's a sense among these groups, who are clearly a fringe extremist group in Jordan and Arab society, but they're attacked precisely because these people don't want Jordan to become dependent on the U.S. and to become an economic or a political protectorate. So the fact that the U.S. is actually giving us an incredible amount of aid and keeping the economy afloat is not a matter that these people like, but that bothers them, and they're lashing out at these symbols in a very violent way.
I do want to come back to that, Rami, because it's central to what we're talking about this hour. I want to bring Fuad Ajami into the conversation, because, Fuad, you're watching this, as many of us are, from this side of the ocean, yeah. and seeing the killing of Lawrence Foley in context of Marines being shot in Kuwait and a growth in anti-American sentiment in Arab countries. Do you see this as directly linked to American plans or policy and Iraq?
I don't necessarily think it's linked to what we're doing in Iraq. Obviously, some people want to scare us away from the region, and we are being targeted, as you yourself, Dick, said in the lead-in to our program quite well. We're being targeted in these pro-American regimes. So two young Kuwaitis, 21 years of age, who trained in Afghanistan, go to this little island off the coast of Kuwait and assault the Marines. They kill a young Marine who's exactly their age, by the way, exactly their age, and they wound another. Then you have this attack on an AID official, again, as you and Rami were chatting about, the symbol, if you will, the benevolent America is also being targeted. So it's the price of standing sentry in that world, being in that world. We are targeted by men in the shadows, and we just simply have to persevere with it.
Nicholas and Rami, you're both in Amman. I wonder if between the two of you, you can take me for a bit of a walk through that city, give us a sense of what the sentiment really is. If you were just stopping and talking to people on the street, either specifically about the assassination or just generally about Jordanian relations with America, what would we be hearing? Nicholas, why don't you start?
One of the very surprising aspects is that although this is the first killing of a Western diplomat in Amman, the first ever killing, what hasn't been very apparent amongst the Jordanians that I've been speaking to so far is a sense of shock. I think they felt that there was a degree of inevitability about the possibility of an attack taking place. Partly they've been prepared for this by constant reports in the Jordanian press that there are militant groups out there who have been put on trial for attempting to carry out attacks on Western and particularly American targets. But also partly it's a sense that many Jordanians don't have that feeling of a benevolent America at their doorstep. They feel that American involvement in the region is as much a threat as an act of benevolence, and I think that was why the feeling amongst a lot of Jordanians was that this was only to be expected.
Rami, you were in the United States for much of last year, returning to Jordan, I think, what, in the summer?
Yes.
Did you go back to a different attitude, something that struck you, that you were hearing from friends, colleagues, folks on the street?
I think a continuation of the same pattern that we've seen for some years now, and I think I would characterize the dominant attribute of people and I think officialdom in most of the Arab world today as deep confusion and uncertainty. There's an amazing amount of terrible contradictions in society. There is no clear focus in terms of what are the big challenges facing our society and what do we need to do about them. What is the problem that has to be resolved, say, with Israel or Iran or Turkey or these non-Arab neighbors? What is the situation with the U.S.? Are they our friend or are they our enemy? Not only is there no consensus about what are the real issues to deal with, there aren't even mechanisms to address these issues. The Arab world is in a deep, deep crisis of confusion and uncertainty and contradictions. And the average person, as I see, and I travel around the Arab world, is standing around like a spectator watching this awful movie develop right in front of their eyes. And as Nick said, it, people have this sense of inevitability that they say, oh, yeah, of course, they're not, you know, they're shocked at the personal level, of course, because any one of us can get killed as an innocent bystander. But the political dominant sentiment is one of inevitability, and there's this terrible movie playing out in front of her eyes, in which people who use guns on all sides, in Israel, in the United States, in the Arab world, throughout Asia, the people with the guns are writing the script, and this is really a pretty ghastly development, and it's getting worse. And I've seen it in the last 3 months since I've been back. It's actually getting a lot worse and not much better. And you could see in the elections in Bahrain the other day, in Pakistan, in Morocco last month, everywhere almost where their people are given a chance to express themselves, you're seeing these Islamist groups. They're not necessarily terrorist groups, but they're groups that are politically militant and Islamist, and they're opposing prevailing government policies. They're doing better all over the place. Turkey is trying to ban them in its elections. So there's a really a terrible crisis of governance, legitimacy, and coherent decision-making in this region, and this is simply one terrible manifestation of it, and I think Americans and Arabs and Israelis and Turks, everybody needs to somehow summon that leadership that we haven't seen for years and years, to summon that leadership to start addressing these issues coherently and together.
Fuad Ajami, the people who live as citizens in countries like Jordan and Syria and Egypt and Lebanon, they have never really been that closely connected to their politicians in the first place. So when Rami Khoury describes them feeling even more alienated, is this something that you particularly, or that you see as troubling?
Well, Dick, you have this road rage in the Arab world, and we are the target. We, America, the United States, is the target of this disgruntlement. Take a look at our position in Jordan, for example. In Jordan, Jordan is the fourth country in the world to have a free trade zone with the United States. That is the two countries in NAFTA and Israel, and Jordan is the fourth. So in a way, and there is a tremendous regard for Jordan and a willingness in Washington to conciliate Jordan, because they read the verdict of 1990-91 right, that in a way the King of Jordan sided with Saddam in response to the street and public opinion in his country. So we court these populations. We do the best we can. But there are plotters in the shadows who pull off these deeds. And then I may want to add something which I think is very fundamental here. There's this general drumbeats of anti-Americanism. So yes, there is the assassin who pulls the trigger, but I think there's also this general inability and unwillingness of Arabs to take control of their own destiny, to stop the scapegoating, to talk about themselves rather than to talk about America. If you and I, Dick, walked into a cafe in anywhere in the Arab world, we would never hear a word about the ruler, because everyone would be afraid. We'd never hear a word about science, about knowledge. It would always be, whatever the local lingo in the place, the vernacular. It's America in Egypt. It's America in somewhere else. And this constant drumbeats about America. And I think it's a disgraceful thing. And I think it begets us, this kind of radicalism. So that beyond the assassins and the plotters, there's a general climate, I think, of abdication in the Arab world.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the place of America in countries that have been long allied with the United States and the way that things are changing in the region. I'll take a moment to say to Nicholas Pelham, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Nicholas is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor based in Amman, and when we come back after our short break, we continue the conversation about what's at play, what's changing in the countries that are neighbors to Iraq. 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. And an hour-long conversation about Jordan this hour. With me on the program, Fuad Ajami. He's a professor of Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University School for Advanced International Studies and author of The Dream Palace of the Arabs, A Generation's Odyssey. Rami Khoury is joining us from Amman, Jordan. He's a senior regional analyst for the International Crisis Group, former editor-in-chief of the Jordan Times, and currently writing an internationally syndicated political column. To both of you, I'm thinking we should perhaps do a little bit of history here before we move much further ahead, because there's been an interesting shift if only looking back over the last 10 years to the run-up, 1990 run-up to the Gulf War, when the man who was at that point Fuad in charge of Jordan, King Hussein, said to the United States, oh, there's no possible way that I can join the coalition. In fact, he made a choice to side with Iraq at that point. Now his son, King Abdullah, is siding with the Americans. What's changed? What do we see in that?
Well, I think, Dick, you've underlined it. I mean, this is the dilemma of Hashemite statecraft. When you have a ruler and a ruling elite and a monarchy which is slightly more moderate and very much more pro-Western than its population, it walks this fine, thin line between its street on the one hand and its Western imperatives and its strategic relationships with the United States on the other. And the late King Hussein, who was one of the finest figures in recent Arab history, and I think Rami would agree with this, and Rami knew him much better and can talk about his statecraft with much greater authority than I can. But nevertheless, in 1967 and in 1991, King Hussein did something that he knew damn well, that it was a doomed choice. In 67, he went to war on the side of the Egyptians against the Israelis in the full knowledge that the Egyptians would be routed. He did it as a concession to his own people because the choice was either war with Israel or civil war within Jordan. He did the same thing in 1990-91. There were two huge calls. His son would appear to be freer today from the passion of the crowd because I think some sobriety has come into Jordan. The Jordanians know now with the wages of what they did in 1990-91. So I think the way I read it is King Abdullah II is freer today than was his father a decade ago to side with the Americans. That's just my own sense of where this pivotal country that you are discussing today is located and is positioned.
Rami, go ahead.
Well, I think that's quite correct, and I would just make a couple of modifications to what Fuad and you also said in the beginning, Dick. Our sense here in Jordan is that the king did not side with Saddam Hussein. He tried desperately in the first days of the occupation of Kuwait to maintain a neutral position so that he could try to do a diplomatic deed and try to somehow get the Iraqis out of Kuwait. Of course, it never happened. But then when the coalition and the war started, he was critical of that effort, and many people would look back. So he didn't side with Saddam, but he was critical of the Western-led militarism, and he clearly did it because of the public opinion in his country. The dilemma that Fuad pointed out for the king is absolutely the correct one.
It's an interesting sort of look back now, because it's more of a case of you're either with us or you're with the enemy in terms of interpreting that, but I hear what you're saying.
Right, but also if you look back, I mean, many of the things that people were saying back then in this region, saying, look, Western militarism is not the answer, some of those things have happened. And, you know, it's one of the things you can see is a direct linear tracing of the problems today, especially bin Laden and al-Qaeda and the bombings against the U.S. Some of them can be related to the after effects of the war in the Gulf and the American military presence. And, of course, there's other reasons, but those are some of the reasons. And the embargo in Iraq, at least that's what bin Laden is talking about when he tries to rally people to his side. So I think there's that situation in the past. Today, the critical thing is that Jordan is economically very heavily dependent on the U.S., not just for its well-being, but almost for its very survival. We're getting this year we're going to get $450 million in aid from the U.S., and our exports to the U.S. with the free trade agreement are going to be around $500 million. So it's almost $1 billion is going to come from the U.S. in trade or aid out of a total GDP of around $9 billion. So it's an extraordinary reliance on one economy. And in fact, the reliance is even more when you look at tourism and other things like that. So Jordan has absolutely no choice but to maintain good relations with the United States for its sheer economic survival. The king and the government here basically say that. They say it in more guarded terms, but they say that Jordan is not going to jeopardize its strategic relationship with the United States. But at the same time, it cannot join an American war against Iraq. So Jordan is going to do what it has generally done pretty well, which is just stay right on the fence and find that fine line between the anti-American policies of your people and the pro-American imperatives of your government and incumbency or economic survival. So that's probably going to continue. And the other new thing, of course, is we have a peace agreement with Israel, and Jordan could not possibly jeopardize that, because if you jeopardize that, then the Americans cut you off. So there's very little maneuvering room for Jordan, and the king has basically made it clear that this is what's going to happen. But he still has to address the issue that there is real, genuine anger, concern, fear, vulnerability, humiliation, whatever you want to call it. All of these terrible emotions are real. They're not phantoms and ghosts in people's mind. People have this strong anger against what Israel is doing to the Palestinians. You've got the policy almost of infanticide now taking place with Israelis killing Palestinian kids and teenagers and this terrible oppression that's going on. And people here see the U.S. as acquiescing in that. That may be right, that may be wrong, but this is the perception. And people are expressing these emotions, and when they see the U.S. doing what it's planning to do in Iraq, they get even even angrier. And it's correct that people criticize the U.S. and Israel more than they criticize their own regimes and political systems, but they are angry at what's going on also in their own countries. And
I'm not sure I understand. You made a reference to infanticide, Rami. I'm not sure I understand that.
Well, the Israeli army has killed several hundred kids under the age of 16, and most of them were shot in the back or in the neck as they were fleeing, and they were certainly not the kids who were lethally threatening, they were not kids who were going to kill Israelis. These were kids throwing stones at tanks. So you've had hundreds of kids killed, and that's just one example. But
if I had a voice from Israel here, the voice would be saying at this point, and look at all the children who died in the suicide bombs on the buses.
Right.
And,
But the Palestinian kids who were killed, as according to Israeli human rights activists, they say that these are kids who were shot when they were not. I mean, these are kids who were not threatening.
Okay.
They were not in a position of lethal threat. But I mean, what I'm saying, that's just an example. There's many others of things happening in Palestine, in Iraq, throughout the region, as well as within the Arab countries. And people get frustrated by what they see around them, and then they try to express it in their own country. They find they're restricted in many cases, and this adds to the frustration. So I think we need to see the correct balance of the sources of people's indignities and anger is a combination of what happens regionally with Israel, what happens with the U.S. or other powers before it was the British and the French, and what happens within their own countries. And I think it's critically important to see those three things as part of one terrible cycle that really plagues people in this region.
Now, Fuad, you were trying to get in here as well, Fuad?
Yeah. Well, I think the argument about infanticide and so on is really way out of place. I think there is a terrible war. We know it has started in September 2000 between the Palestine National Authority and Israel. I think there have been these suicide attacks which brutalized the Israelis. And I don't think such labels as infanticide really do us any favor here. But I think it speaks to this general. I mean, even in Rami's remarks, and he is one of the most decent people in Jordan and the most thoughtful people, I think there is this kind of flight from responsibility, if you will, and flight from precision, I think. That really is what's happening in the Arab world. And I think that average Americans would be forgiven if they were to look at Jordan and cite these facts and statistics that Rami gave about the dependence of Jordan on the United States and the generosity of the United States to Jordan, and there's still the depth of this anti-Americanism in Jordan. There is an odd thing in this Arab world. There is something peculiar about the populations throughout the Arab world for whom America is the first choice of a place of emigration. And yet is this country about which they speak, they say nothing kind, nothing generous, and nothing knowledgeable. And these conspiracy theories about America and Israel, which inhabit the Arab world and just float over it, it's a poison. There is a kind of poison in Arab public life. And it's sorrowful to watch it. It plays out in Jordan. It plays out in Egypt. It plays out in Kuwait. And I just want to quote one Kuwaiti who's a remarkable figure, Shafiq Ghabra, a good friend of mine, a very, very decent liberal secular intellectual. In the aftermath of the murder of this young Marine in Kuwait, he said that there are three places that we have to reclaim, that the secular liberal people in the Arab world will have to reclaim: the mosque, They'll have to reclaim that. The school, they'll have to get their schools back from these Islamists, from these fundamentalists who spread nothing but vile hate and anti-Americanism. And we have to get back the police station, he said. In fact, that the governments will have to enforce the laws. So it's an Arab dilemma that we are dealing with here. And I think that in these countries which have pro-American governments and anti-American population, therein lies the riddle. A certain alienation between ruler and ruled, in which we, the United States, are caught in the middle of this kind of vicious crossfire.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to start in Vineyard Haven, Massachusetts. Bob's on the line. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of agree with where you're, you know, some of the premises of your speakers or your panel. And it seems to me that most, you know, this assassination in Jordan, I mean, it's just, you know, it's like here and there, and it's where it's going to be next. You know, it's like, to me, the Arab people are crying for freedom and a certain control of their own destiny, which they haven't had because of the colonial powers that have been, that have installed their little rulers and their little kingdoms and their security forces.
Are you saying that the United States is complicit in that separation?
Yes, sir. I definitely am, unfortunately. I wish I didn't have to say that because I love my country as much as the next person, you know? But I almost think Osama bin Laden is also quite an Al-Qaeda group, is a fundamentalist Islamic group.
Let me, Bob, if I can, just take the point of your call and ask Rami to speak about it in Jordanian terms. Because, Rami, I remember the funeral of King Hussein. The man was revered in the country. His son, King Abdullah, is, I'm led to believe, extremely well-respected. He goes into disguise and shows up in villages without people knowing that he's there so he can figure out what's going on in the country. How do we square that with what we've been saying throughout the program, that there's a disconnect between those who rule and those who are ruled?
Well, I think these complexities and nuances and contradictions are the reality that defines our world. I mean, I agree with most of Fuad's analysis, but I would disagree on the point saying that nobody in the Arab world has a kind word for the U.S. And I think that kind of sweeping statement is both inaccurate and I think it diverts the debate. The reality is that every day people here speak well of the United States. Today I had a friend who spoke to one of the leading political leaders of the Islamist movement, the Islamic Action Party, who got a PhD in the United States. And this Islamist fellow was saying how much he likes the U.S. and he's glad he went there and he wants to send his kids there, but he criticizes American policy. There are no one size answer fits all. This is a complexity that you do have these contradictions. We send our kids to the U.S. We like to go there. We buy American products, but we're critical of American policies in most cases, and we are supportive of American policies in other cases. And we make those distinctions clearly, daily, in public, in private, throughout the Arab world. And I think what one of the problems we have is, frankly, the Western media is not relaying this complexity of views. And Shafiq Ghabra is somebody I have great respect for as well. And it's these kind of people who are asserting themselves now throughout the Arab world and trying to fight both the tradition of autocratic governance by centralized states and the dominance of the public debate by extremist groups, whether they're Islamists on the right or...
But Rami, you know as well as I do as a journalist that one assassin's bullet and one bomb will take all that goodwill and completely submerge it.
Well, it probably could, and this is the challenge. So that's why I'm saying we have problems that are rooted here, and all the things we've been talking about are real. These problems of democracy, right, of human rights, of social equity, economic disparities are real problems, and we've got to address them, and people are trying to do that in many parts of the Arab world. But the Israeli policies, the American policies, are equal realities. They are not figments of imaginations. And to talk of colonialism is an important element for people in this region, but this is not about the past. The Arab governments states have been independent for many, many years, many decades. And there's a problem in terms of coherent good governance in these countries, and it's compounded by these complexities with the Israeli link and the American link and others. So I think there are no straight answers that describe everything, and we need to look at these nuanced situations and figure out what do the local people need to do in the Arab countries, what do we need to do between Israel and the Arabs, how can the U.S., the Europeans, and others be helpful. And I think through that kind of working together, we can probably address the issues and take back that centrist majority middle ground, take it back from these killers and these extremists and these fanatics who are dominating this region.
Let me go ahead with our calls. Thanks to Bob for your call to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Wireless joining us. Hi there.
Yes, hi. I want to make a couple of comments about Fuad Ajami's statements regarding, first of all, I feel that Fuad Ajami is labeling all the Arab population in an extreme way. And I want to comment about the disconnect that he talks about between the Arab governments and their populations. I feel that that's actually a result of appointed governments that are nothing less than being appointed and blessed by the West to preserve the Western interests in the region to the detriment of the population. Fuad seems to me as a mouthpiece for Western dominance or a self-hater. I hate to say that.
Well, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask you to stay on the line. We're taking a quick break for a couple of messages here, and I want to let Fuad speak to your point give you a chance as well to talk when we come back. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. The subject this hour, the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan and the situation that it faces right now, the situation that it will face if the U.S. pushes ahead with its plans for an attack against Iraq. 1-800-423-TALK. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number 1-800-423-TALK this hour, talking about Jordan and the situation that the country finds itself in what could be the run-up to a war with Iraq, its friendship with the United States, more than half its population Palestinian, and the dilemma faced there. Just before we went to a break, Weil from Cambridge suggested that Fuad Ajami, one of my guests on the program, is being a bit of an apologist for the West here. Fuad, back to you.
Thank you very much, Dick. I think that when the caller said that he hated to say that I was a self-hater, I think I disagree with him, partly when he said, with both parts of the equation, that he hated to say it. I think he came ready to say it. He didn't really hate to say it. And I think there is someone much greater than myself, and that was the great writer Joseph Conrad, who once said something about his relationship to Poland, which I always quote, which goes something like this: it would take too long to explain the intimate alliance of contradictions that makes love itself wear at times the desperate shape of betrayal. My love for the Arab world and my relation to Arab modernity and secularism is all written in everything I've done and chronicled. I have retrieved the record of emancipated and liberated men and women. I have chronicled their lives, their struggles. Read The Dream Palace of the Arabs. I'd love to give the caller a free copy. And if he can see hate in that work, then he is welcome to it. So above and beyond my own sensibility, I think I wanted to stay on the issue of Jordan and the issue of public opinion and the way people read America. I think Rami is right. I mean, there is this kind of the feeling in Jordan. I think we've kind of addressed, and I think we'll go around it yet another round. I think there are two governments in the region, Kuwait and Qatar, which are pledged, if you will, to be allies of America in broad daylight. I think many other governments will be with America in the shadows. So, for example, Jordan will be coy about its relationship to this war. And Washington tolerates that coyness. It understands the need for that coyness. So at the same time, for example, that we have joint exercises, the Americans have joint exercises with the Jordanians, we allow the Jordanians to say, we don't intend to have any role in this new war against Iraq. There is subtlety in Washington, an understanding that these rulers live in very, very difficult places and have to walk that fine, thin line. And that's why Jordan is interesting, because it will be a very pivotal country to watch. And it will speak to that tendency in the Arab world to be allied with America quietly, in the shadows, behind closed doors, and then to partake of some anti-Americanism in order to please the crowd out in the street.
While I said I'd give a word to you, can you speak about Jordan?
I'm not sure what to say about Jordan, but I feel that I haven't been to Jordan in years. I feel that... are you still there?
Yes.
Yes. The alliance, first of all, what is the United States' purpose of going into the Middle East?
It's a pretty broad question.
Yes.
I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to move along. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And next to Providence, Rhode Island, Ron's on the line. Ron, have you been to Jordan?
Yes, I've been to Jordan. I was in Amman the week after King Hussein died, and I love Jordan. I love the Middle East. I've been there more than once. I think people didn't expect a whole lot of King Hussein's successor, but I think he's turned out to be a sleeper.
You mean that in a complimentary way, right?
In a complimentary way. He is a visionary. He has a vision. He's passionate and he's calm at the same time. He's very intelligent. He has peripheral vision. And he could be such a our point man in the Middle East, if you will. But I don't think we're listening to him. About 6 or 8 weeks ago, he came up to the microphones and he says, I have a proposal that if acted upon will result in the creation of a Palestinian state in 3 years, which is the goal of the Bush administration. And we haven't heard a word about it in this country.
Rami Khoury, is it true that that King Abdullah doesn't get the credibility for wisdom that perhaps he should?
Well, I think King Abdullah has done extremely well on the economic side. He's really done prize-winning work in reform, innovation, doing things in terms of IT and high-tech and reorienting the economy. And he's done really, I think, very, very exemplary work. On the political side, he hasn't done the same thing. And I think this is the dilemma that King Abdullah represents, that Jordan represents, that plagues the whole region, that people want to open up their markets. They want to get the young kids in school and educated and learning computers and thriving in the global economy, but they don't have very many elections, or elections are postponed, demonstrations are not allowed to take place sometimes, professional groups that get into politics or have constraints put on them. There's this terrible, terrible contradiction between freeing the mind of the young Arab man and woman and at the same time limiting that person's participation in political decision-making. And this is the dilemma that I think faces everybody in the region, and Jordan is grappling with it like everybody else. And the anger, the frustration that develops at the grassroots level often gets channeled into anti-American sentiment. But I would repeat again that the single biggest source of people's grievances in most of the Arab countries, and the reason why Islamist groups keep winning and doing well in elections, are domestic grievances, economic, political, social, and other domestic grievances. But they're often expressed in an anti-American or an anti-Israeli vocabulary, and I think people need to be much more discerning about the relationships between those three sources of grievance.
Our number is 1-800 423-8255. Ron, thanks for that. To East Greenwich, Rhode Island, David's on the line. David?
Yes, I'd like to comment that I've been to the Middle East many times and have been a student of the politics and the international relations for a long, long time. It strikes me that Arab societies, in many ways, are very violent. Violence is accepted as a means of dispute resolution between individuals, between families, and between states. And it seems
Don't you
to me,
think the Arabs would say the same thing about the United States with its plans for an attack
well,
on Iraq?
I think a little bit different. And what I'm talking about is if I have a grudge or a grievance against you individually, I might go and physically attack you or your family. It's a tradition that goes back thousands of years. The Arab society is not, the exclusive.
You know what, David? I just don't get your remark here. I mean, it sounds like you're just saying Arabs like to hit each other in the head. It just sounds like a racist comment.
It's not a racist comment. It's a comment of fact that, in point of fact, societally, there are means of dealing with problems that are acceptable in Arab society that include violence that are not, you know, simply not acceptable here. If you offend,
wait a second, this is a country that has the death penalty.
I'm sorry?
This is a country that has the death penalty.
Yes, that's a different story, though. I'm not talking about state action or governmental action. I'm talking about individual action. If you go and rape my sister or beat up my brother, I may be compelled, for the family honor, to go and do the same thing to your family, to your sister, to your brother, or whatever. I mean, I'd like to hear your panelists comment on it, because I think it's something that if Arab society can deal with in some constructive manner, may help the situation.
All right, David, I'm not quite clear, but I will ask Fuad, who, you know, to sort of help us with an understanding of Americans' understanding of Arab society.
I think these remarks were not very helpful. I don't think that's the heart of the matter. The heart of the matter is that the political center in the Arab world, in the 80s in particular, I really take you to the 80s, the political center in the Arab world was destroyed. And demography overwhelmed that world. So when you have a population that's 40% of the population is under 14, and you have the pressing of populations on their governments, on the limited resources, the break of the compact between generations, and then, of course, you have the deterioration of civic authority in many, many Arab societies. Civil war in Lebanon, my own birthplace, which took, I don't know how many, maybe 150,000 people. Just a terrible civil war that lasted about a quarter century. A great, great civil war, a brutal war in Algeria between the Islamists and the, what some people have called Hezbollah, the party of God, and Hezbollah France, the party of France, between the secularists and the Islamists, between the rulers and the Islamists. So there has been a great amount of killing in Arab lands. And there was a great amount of killing on the Iraq-Iran battlefields. So, but it's not really about the character of the people. It's really about the terrible history and this great, great demographic explosion. It really is the fundamental story yet to be appreciated, which runs through Al-Qaeda. It runs through everything we've been talking about. Is the birth rates in the Arab world, the destruction of every, in many ways, the destruction of the economic center and political center of these societies, and it's overwhelming by a birth rate that had just played havoc with these lands.
Rami
Khoury?
Yeah,
I would agree with that, and I think there is a fury that you can see throughout the Arab world. You see it in the terror acts, you see it in the widespread popular support for extremist position, and it is a fury that is born, I think, primarily from the distorted and abusive use of power by the combination of state authorities and individual groups in society. I mean, there's very few people who can be let off the hook in the Arab world. The private sector has often done some pretty awful things in terms of exploiting people. And so there's a lot of blame to pass around within the Arab world. I think the important thing to say, though, is as somebody who has been here for the last 30 years and insists on staying here and trying to see what can be done from within the region, is that there's tremendous dynamism at the grassroots level. People in NGOs and schools and homes and tribal councils and whatever institution you want to look at are trying to figure out what's the problem and how can we resolve it? And there's still the single biggest problem, I think, that probably underlies all of these things that we've talked about, is the misuse of power by small elites who are neither elected nor accountable to their people in any formal structure. And those elites have been heavily supported by the U.S. And this is the terrible link that keeps coming back and back.
But Jordan is not about to do away with the monarchy, Rami. I mean, we need to put...
Sorry. Yeah, we should be clear. Nobody's threatening the monarchy. I think Jordan has one of the more enlightened leaderships in the region, and people who compare Jordan to other countries in the region generally see the positive things. But there's a lot of also complaints that people have within the country that are legitimate about elections, the quality of democracy, civil society.
Parliamentary elections have been canceled three times in the last little while, am I right?
Well, they were postponed.
They were postponed
twice.
Okay.
Postponed twice, and the king has promised to hold them in the spring. But a lot of people feel that we need more democracy, not the postponement of democracy. And this is a legitimate debate, and the king and the government engage people in it. And so we're one of the better-off countries in the region. There's an awful lot of police states and tyrannies in our region that are worse off than us, but that's not really the measure to compare yourself against police states. The problems are common throughout the region. It's a question of degree, really, that separates a lot of the Arab countries.
Let me turn to Fuad Ajami.
But you have these problems.
Rami has it absolutely right. I mean, Jordan is a benevolent form of authoritarianism. And just to tweak the story a little bit, there are speculations that should we go to war in Iraq and should there be a post-Saddam Iraq, there is even possibly a Hashemite future for Iraq, since the Hashemite governed Iraq from 1921 to 1958. They are still in Jordan. That the Iraqis look across the border and see that Jordan has been well governed, lucky to have had two great kings, Abdullah I and King Hussein, and a promising young man, as we hear, in Abdullah II. There are even all kinds of possibilities. There is even an unemployed former crown prince of Jordan, that's Prince Hassan, who was removed by his brother, who's been talked about as possibly a king of a post-Saddam Iraq. So it may be back to the future for Iraq. The Hashemites could be heard from yet across the border from Jordan.
Gentlemen, we will talk more about this. I have no doubt about that. Rami Khoury, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Rami is an internationally syndicated political columnist, senior regional analyst for the International Crisis Group, joining us from Amman, Jordan. Fuad Ajami, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Fuad is a professor of Middle Eastern Studies at the Johns Hopkins University School for Advanced International Studies. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Graham Smith is our senior producer. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.